Welcome, everybody, to another episode of It's About Time. This is our 11th episode. My name is Nate. I will be flying solo tonight. Josh, my co-host, was unable to make it. He got stuck at work, and we could not find another day this week that worked well to record. So I decided to fly solo this week. So we'll see how this goes. Got a nice glass of scotch sitting here, and we're just going to run through the weekend in sports, DC sports mainly. We're going to talk about the Redskins. Pretty decent 23-17 win over Carolina. Going to go through that. Going to go through the NFC East. We're going to talk about next week's opponent. It is Dallas week for those of us that still think that's a thing. It's a Dallas week. Dallas big winners over Jacksonville. Probably one of the more surprising games of the weekend. They were 40-7 winners over Jacksonville. Just boat race them. It's one of my new favorite terms, by the way, boat race. I know it's not a new term, but it's a new term to me. We'll go around the NFC East. I think the Eagles probably put the final nail in the Giants' coffin this year. The Giants are now 1-5. Carson Wentz had a nice day. Saquon Barkley continues to build on his myth. So we'll talk about that. We have a mixed bag at the end. I'll hit a little bit of Caps, a little bit of Wizards. We'll talk about the MLB playoffs. And I'll finish with a little bit of Nats talk. Before we start, we'll remind everybody that we are affiliated with the DMVSportsNetwork.com. They can be followed on Twitter at DMV_SN. They have some great daily content on all DC sports, Redskins, Caps, Nats, Wizards, tennis, fantasy football. So be sure to check them out. They also have some great podcasts over there and written content, a podcast that I've started to listen to because I seriously need the help with fantasy football is Fantasy Fever by our friend Marcus. He does a great job. Has a very smooth and mellow voice too, so it certainly helps to get fantasy advice from Marcus with Fantasy Fever, especially when it's coming with a smooth and kind of easy and relaxed voice. So anyway, let's jump in to the Redskins. 23-17 winners over Carolina. The first question I had, I would ask Josh this. Why does winning feel this bad? I really don't have an answer for it. The game was excruciating to watch, especially the second half. I think it's a symptom of the years of abuse that we faced as Redskin fans, for those of you listening that are Redskin fans. When things can go wrong, it's like a Murphy's Law type deal. It usually does. And the entire second half yesterday felt like the Redskins were going to blow it. The offense only scored 6 points. There were two drives consecutively where Carolina seemed to move the ball with ease. And you were just waiting for the other shoe to drop. And I remember I let out an audible scream. I was the only person in my house. My kids were at a birthday party with my wife. I let out an audible scream when Cam Newton's fourth down pass was incomplete. I couldn't believe it. I genuinely was waiting for them to score and for the game to end. And I don't know what kind of fan that makes me. I'm certainly jaded. But also, this team can still surprise. When they put up a predictable finish like they did, or a predictable game in general like they did, laying an egg on Monday night against the Saints, they come back and surprise us against Carolina. I don't know why it takes being embarrassed for this team to focus. I don't know why it takes getting just stomped for this team to... I'm not saying they don't work hard, but I think that they, especially the one player that seemed sincerely focused this week, was Josh Norman. And when he's focused, as you can see, he had a pretty easy interception. It wasn't really great. I mean, it was decent coverage by him. The ball was severely underthrown by Cam Newton, and it was basically like a punt. But he did have an interception, he had a fumble recovery, and he seemed to be the on-field emotional leader that the team needed. I hope that carries through. I hope that Jay can find a way to motivate Josh Norman. Maybe this will motivate Josh Norman through the rest of the season. Maybe it was a wake-up call. Getting benched for the first series in the second half against New Orleans because he wouldn't take his headphones off while Coach Gruden was talking to the team. Maybe that's the fire that they needed. I read an article last week that said Carolina and Ron Rivera got the best out of Josh Norman when they basically were getting ready to get rid of him. And Josh Norman was playing for his football career. He doesn't have to do that anymore. He's financially secure. He got the big deal. The Redskins have to find a way to continue to motivate him and motivate the rest of the team. The offense is another story. The defense, when they're motivated and when they play together, they're one of the best defensive units in the NFC. They are. And they can keep this team in football games. They only gave up 17 points to a Carolina team that scored, 33 the week before. They're a good football team. Cam Newton's a good quarterback, and he had his moments yesterday, but did not dominate the way I thought that he might. The Redskins only rushed 4 most of the day. They forced Cam to look through coverage, and they did a pretty decent job. Outside of a couple drives in the second half, they did a pretty decent job. So let's go through the game. I want to start with the first 3 series. My first question is, Carolina gets the ball to start the game, and they're pretty quickly 4th-and-1 at their own 47. My first question, why didn't Carolina go for it? You got a 6'5" beast of a quarterback who can sneak it. You've got Christian McCaffrey in the backfield. Why don't you go for it? Instead, they punt the ball, and yes, the Redskins go 3-and-out. But then the Panthers fumble the punt return, and Sprinkle recovers it, and one play later, 22-yard touchdown pass to Vernon Davis. So the Redskins are up 7-0. Honestly, I mean, it was pretty much based on the fumble during the punt, but had Carolina lost a chance to really gain some momentum at the beginning of the game, going for it on 4th-and-1. And it'll show you, because on the Skins' next offensive drive, Carolina punts, Skins' next offensive drive, they're in a very similar situation, 4th-and-1 at their own 45, similar to the situation Carolina was in, and they go for it. And they end up picking up the first down. It was a QB sneak by Alex. He did a couple of those yesterday. And then the drive ends as they continue moving down the field, 2-yard touchdown pass to Paul Richardson. It was their best sustained drive of the day, 12 plays, 64 yards, ending in a touchdown. They had, surprisingly throughout the day, a lot of long drives. That drive was 12 plays, 6 minutes and 14 seconds. They had a drive towards the end of the second quarter, 10 plays, 5 minutes and 54 seconds that ended in a field goal. And then 2 of their 4 drives in the second half were over 10. Actually, if you look at their first drive when they got the ball to start the second half was 9 plays, then 12 plays, then 10 plays. They moved the ball yesterday. They ate up clock. But that drive, 12 plays, 64 yards, was their best sustained drive because it ended in a touchdown, a 2-yard touchdown pass to Paul Richardson. Where I think the Redskins could have really won the football game yesterday, they did win the football game, don't get me wrong, but where I think they really could have won the game early and kind of coasted to a victory. They had this golden opportunity, and they had it twice before the half because they were getting the ball to start the second half. They first get the ball with 3:05 left and start at their own 25 after a Carolina touchdown. And they drive the ball down to about the Carolina 44 and they end up punting it. And Tressway does a beautiful job pinning Carolina inside. It was a nice play by Brian Quick, pinning them inside the 5-yard line. Carolina eventually goes 3-and-out. Skins get the ball back, this time at Carolina's 33. They're already in field goal range. With 56 seconds left, there was the phantom intentional grounding on Alex Smith. Capri Bibbs was clearly in the area. It should be a play that can be reviewed. It was not. So the Redskins end up going 3-and-out and losing 6 yards because of the intentional grounding. And instead of kicking a field goal, they actually got driven out of field goal range and punt again. They could have scored before the half and done what the Patriots do all the time. You score. And then it's a 2-score swing because then you get the ball back to start the second half. I thought that was really a golden opportunity that they missed. Had the opportunity, they were up at that point 17-6. They could have been up 20-6 going into the half. They could have been up 24-6. they really let Carolina stay in the game by not being as efficient on offense as they could have been. The biggest play of the game to me, as we continue to move along in the game, was the Trent Williams fumble recovery, which is weird to say. He caught a fumble in midair. Alex Smith got hit as he was attempting to throw a ball, but it was a fumble. And Trent runs 8 yards, keeping the Redskins in field goal range. That's the play of the game. No other way to look at it. You can look at the 22-yard touchdown pass to Vernon Davis. You can look at the fourth down incompletion by Cam Newton. All of those pale in comparison to the fumble recovery by Trent Williams, because it changes the dynamic of the game. Kept them in field goal range, and it was a big field goal. They ended up winning by 6. It was a big field goal. And then let's talk about Dustin Hopkins. I mean, how big of a stud is this guy? After the Trent Williams recovery, he nuts one from 56 yards with ease. Would have been good from 60. He went 3 for 3 on the day. He's 10 for 11 on the year from field goal range. The guy's a stud. It's really nice. It's really nice to have special teams guys that you can sincerely count on. He's amazing. Kicks the ball out of the end zone when they need to. You remember the years with Kai Forbath not being able to get the ball to the end zone, how frustrating that was, allowing returns. Dustin Hopkins, unless there's a design play, boots it through the end zone every time. And then Tress Way. He's my team MVP. Love the guy. Pins him deep. And you rarely see him mishandle a snap. You rarely see him duff a punt, kick one off to the side. He does what he's supposed to do. The special teams, for once on this team, and for years the special teams has been a giant question mark, but the special teams for once this year is stable. And they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're not hurting the Redskins. Special teams for them, they did help win a game yesterday by making 3 field goals, and Tressway was deadly accurate punting the ball. But they're not going to lose you a game, and that's what you can't have a special teams unit do. This special teams unit is not going to lose them a game. The Skins did offensively eat a lot of clock in the second half, but they only scored 6 points. They did just enough on offense to win the game. That's as complimentary as I can be about the offensive performance in the second half. They did just enough to win the game. They ate up clock, and they kept Cam Newton off the field. They limited Carolina's chances offensively. That's essentially what it came down to. Carolina in the second half had 3 drives because of how much the Redskins ate clock. And then when Carolina did have drives, the Washington defense forced Carolina to move the ball. There was 11 plays, then 9 plays. And even the drive that ended on downs after the fourth down, that was 12 plays. No quick strikes. The Redskins' offense, in tandem with the defense, did just enough to win the football game yesterday. That's as good as I can say for the offense yesterday. I mean, if you want to talk about Adrian Peterson, the guy, how lucky are we as Redskin fans that he was out there and he was available? Really. He's been the difference. He was the difference in the Green Bay game. He was the difference yesterday. He was somewhat the difference in the Arizona game, although the Arizona game was never close. Yesterday, Adrian Peterson had 17 carries for 97 yards. And let's not forget, the guy dislocated his shoulder Monday night. 6 days later, he's back out on the field playing through pain. And he took some pretty big shots yesterday, but 17 carries, 97 yards. His long was 19 yards. The guy's a stud. Even at 33, he's a stud. I'm glad to have him on the team. We really, as Redskins fans, we need him this week against Dallas. Dallas is, I believe, 7th in the NFL rush defense. Let me confirm that. Yeah, they're only giving up 3.5 yards per carry so far on the ground. We need Adrian Peterson. We need everybody. We need Chris Thompson back. Thompson didn't play yesterday. Jamison Crowder didn't play yesterday. That certainly impacted how the passing game worked. Alex Smith was 21 of 36 for 163 yards. He did have 2 touchdowns, and he did take 3 sacks for a loss of 7 yards. Smith also used his legs a little bit, had 16 carries for 13 yards. Smith held on to the ball a lot yesterday. I don't know if it's because the receivers weren't getting open. I don't know if it's because Alex is trying to be too fine. Or I also don't know. The main question that popped into my head is it possible that Alex Smith doesn't have a full grasp of the offense yet? Would be completely acceptable. The guy's only played 5 games. He barely played in the preseason. It's his first year in a relatively complex offense. Is it possible that the combination of really a lack of wide receiver talent and the fact that it's his first year in the offense, is it possible that sometimes when he drops back to pass, he just doesn't know where to go with the football? I think it's possible. And I also think it's possible that his guys are not getting the separation that they need to get. Because the receivers didn't really have a banner day. Paul Richardson is getting more comfortable. He's becoming a bit of a safety valve a little bit, but he only had 3 catches for 31 yards. Vernon Davis had a decent day, had the big 22-yard touchdown catch. He went 3 catches, 48 yards. Jordan Reed, 5 catches, but only 36 yards. Doxson finally getting on the board, 3 catches, 20 yards, but again, non-factor. The key play that sticks out in my mind, Alex tries to hit Doxson down the sideline. Doxson's got no separation on the DB. Didn't fight for the ball in the air. The guy, my estimation of him is that he doesn't run good routes and he doesn't get separation. And if that's the case, they've got 3 guys that are better than him. I'd like to see Michael Floyd get more involved. You're starting to see Maurice Harris, who had 3 catches, only 13 yards, but he also ran the ball once, but he was a decoy a couple of times. I'd like to see Mo Harris and Michael Floyd get some more opportunities. I'd even potentially like to see Brian Quick get some opportunities. He had 2 catches for 12 yards. But still, their outside options are extremely limited. It is a horse that has been dead, and we have been beating it over and over again, but they have no outside weapons. They have none. The one play I really loved, and I'd like to see them do more of it, they line up trips right, and the 3 trips are the 3 tight ends. You've got Sprinkle, Davis, and Reed. I love that. The two tight ends go out and block, and I think it was Jordan Reed catches it, picks up. I think it was something like 9 yards, 10 yards, something like that. I love that. I'd like to see more of it. Your most talented skill position set that can catch the ball right now are your tight ends, closely followed by your running backs when Chris Thompson is healthy. Your receivers are a very distant third. And I feel for Alex Smith. He doesn't have the weapons. But also, I think as he gets more accustomed in this offense, I think we'll see him perform a little bit better. Let's talk about Daron Payne for a second. Wasn't a very flashy day for him, but I saw a couple plays by him. The kid's going to be a stud. He is going to be a stud. He moves so quickly for a guy his size. He hits like a sack of bricks. When he begins to improve and really starts to come into his own, I believe this wholeheartedly, he will be one of the best interior defensive linemen in all of football. The guy's a beast. You pair him with Jonathan Allen, the two of them could really wreak havoc for the next several years for the Redskins. I love that defensive line. Throw in Ioannidis. They've really got something cooking with their front seven. The defense did have a rough go of it for 2 drives in the second half. They gave up 2 long drives. The one drive that was really concerning was the touchdown drive in the second half. The Panthers went 9 plays, 75 yards in just over 4 minutes, ended in a touchdown. Their receivers were running free. It looked like the Redskins were playing almost like a prevent defense. They were playing soft coverage. And they got the 2-point conversion on the identical play that they got the touchdown. The defense made no adjustments. So they did have a bit of a stumble there. End of the third quarter, into the fourth quarter, giving up 10 points. But they stiffened up. They bent, but they did not break. Defense had a decent day. They only gave up 17 points. They had a decent day. That's pretty much all I had in regards to how the team played. I like how Jay came out. You know, he had the team prepared. The big question for me, we touched on this a little bit earlier. What's it going to take to motivate this team for the next 11 games? Jay Gruden does not have a history of consistency. The Redskins in general don't have a history of consistency. Per DC Sports Blog, Mr. Dan Steinberg, this is an amazing statistic. Well, actually, it's technically two statistics. The first statistic is the Redskins are 1-7 in their last eight games following a victory. That's terrible. That means that they get complacent after winning one football game. Almost as remarkable, their last two games, obviously the Redskins are 1-1. Their last four, they're 2-2. Their last six, they're 3-3. Their last 10, they're 5-5. Their last 12, they're 6-6. Their last 14, they're 7-7. Their last 20 games, the Redskins are 10-10. Their last 33 games, they're 16-16-1. And their last 37 games, the Redskins are 18-18-1. They are the poster child for mediocrity. They play 500 football. They win a game, and then they kind of take a game off. They win a game, they take a game off. So the question moving forward, how does Jay Gruden motivate this football team to play as hard as they did against Arizona, against Green Bay, and against the Panthers, to play that hard the rest of the season? Obviously, money not going to do it because these guys, for the most part, are financially set. This is going to be, as much as it's going to be a big test for the Redskins to determine how good they can be, I think that this is the ultimate test. This might be the final exam for Jay Gruden, the final 11 games of the season. It might be their final exam. Might be the final exam for ownership, for management, to determine whether Jay deserves to continue being the head coach. Can he consistently motivate the team to put forward 110% each week? Because it's fair to say that through the first five games, they've gone good, bad, good, bad, good. And the two bad games, you can certainly tie it to bad game plan, lack of effort. So, and that's certainly coaching. It has a lot to do with the players, too. The players are adults. They're men. They're professional athletes. But it's going to be fascinating to watch over the next 11 games, starting with this Dallas game coming up. The Redskins have been given a gift. They've earned a little bit of it, but they've been given a gift. For the second time in 3 weeks, they are going to have the opportunity to establish themselves as a force in the NFC. Here's what I mean by that. They went into the Monday night game against the Saints. I mean, they were 2-1 through three games. And the Saints' offense was flying high. Had the Redskins won that game, it would have been a statement game. It would have said to the rest of the NFC, not just the NFC East, but the rest of the NFC, this team's for real. They have a good defense. Their offense can score enough points. This team's for real. And they come out and they lay an egg. And then most of the league, they leave them for dead. Well, it's the Redskins. It's what they do. They're going to lose to the Panthers. Then they come out and they play a solid football game against the Panthers. The game plan was decent. The defense played with their hair on fire. The Redskins were barely penalized. Only five penalties for 43 yards. It was a clean game. They deserved to win that football game. It may have been excruciating to watch, but they deserved to win that football game. So then they make the statement, hey, we're a decent team. We could beat a good team. The Panthers are a good team. This is their chance. I'm not saying Dallas is a great football team. They're not. They're 3-3. But Dallas is coming off a pretty big win of their own. This is the opportunity. This is the opportunity to once again say, hey, you beat Dallas, you're 4-2. You're at least a game clear in the division unless Philly, you know, you're a game clear with Dallas, plus you've got a game up because you've beaten them. This is a second chance in three games to establish yourself, establish an identity. Because right now their identity, to use a phrase of my co-host, Jekyll and Hyde. And obviously somebody on the Fox broadcast has been listening to this podcast because they did a Jekyll and Hyde graphic. This team has been Jekyll and Hyde. they either come out like gangbusters or they come out as flat as can be. That starts with the head coach. Next 11 games is a big, big test for Jay Gruden, and it might be his final exam with the Washington Redskins. If he passes, he gets to keep going. If he doesn't pass, this might be it. They've given him 5 years. You can't say that Dan Snyder, has not given, I almost said Dan Steinberg. Dan Steinberg does not own the Washington Redskins. But you can't say that Dan Snyder has not been at least somewhat patient with Jay Gruden. I don't think the options have been particularly great in the coaching field, but he's certainly been patient with Jay Gruden. And this is his final exam. And I hope he passes. I really like Jay. He's an offensive mastermind. This is his biggest test as well with the offense because he doesn't have weapons. He has a quarterback that can be efficient, but he doesn't have a quarterback that can win the game by himself. He's essentially, I mean, I wouldn't say he's got Andy Dalton again because Dalton, first of all, had A.J. Green. But Alex Smith is a step ahead, in my opinion, of Andy Dalton, but the weapons just aren't there. So Jay's going to have to get creative. I look forward to it. I look forward to seeing it. I'm sure that the games are going to be as excruciating as last week was because the defense is going to have to step up big late in games. The offense is just not going to run away from teams. My prediction for the Redskins this week against the Cowboys, I think the Skins are going to eke out a close victory. I think, based on what the guys have said, I think that the Saints game was a wake-up call. I think that they were thoroughly embarrassed. And I think that they're ready to prove that they're not a mediocre football team, that they're not a team that could gets complacent so easily. I think they come out, it's a division game, they're playing at home. Not that home really matters, in my opinion, at FedEx Field. That's a different story. But it's a division game against your arch rival. I think they eke out a close game. I think that Adrian Peterson, Chris Thompson, and Samaje Perine will combine for, and probably Capri Bibbs, you can throw him in there too, will combine for 35 carries and 165 yards at least. I think they're going to run the ball heavily. I think that they're going to pound the rock. They're going to try to keep Dak off the field. I think the Skins win 24-20. I think it's going to be similar to the Panthers game. I think the Redskins might get an early lead, and then they're going to try to hold on. That's pretty much what they do. That's their MO. I'm looking forward to the game. I'm excited. I'm glad to be excited. It's rare for me to be excited for a Redskin game, at least over the last 5 to 10 years. I'm excited to watch it 4:25 on Sunday against the Cowboys. This game does suit the Skins well, though. Skins can stop the run and play man-to-man outside on the weaker receivers of Dallas. They need to spy Dak. Tavon Austin's most likely not going to play for Dallas. The Skins are ninth in passing defense at 236 yards a game. They're sixth in rushing defense at 90 yards per game. Let's talk about Dallas real quick, next week's opponent. They were 40-7 winners over Jacksonville. Zeke Elliott had another nice day, 24 carries, 106 yards, and a touchdown. Dak had a decent day passing, 17 of 27, 183 yards and 2 touchdowns, but where he really made his mark, 11 carries, 82 yards, rushing and a touchdown. Dallas had 206 yards total rushing. That's the big story next week. Dallas's rushing offense against the Redskins' rushing defense. But I do think the game suits the Redskins well. The Skins can stop the run. I think that they can stuff the box. I think they can play man-to-man outside. Dallas doesn't have great weapons. I think Cole Beasley could be covered man-to-man. Tavon Austin is out. I think if you put a spy on Dak, maybe Zach Brown, maybe even DJ Swearinger, you keep him in the pocket, I think you can limit heavily Dallas's offense. Again, Skins ninth in passing defense, sixth in rushing defense. I think the Redskins win 24-20. The other game in the NFC East was Thursday night. The Eagles did a beatdown of the Giants, 34-13. Carson Wentz had a nice day, 26 of 36, 278 yards and 3 touchdowns. Saquon Barkley, what hasn't been said about Saquon Barkley? He had 13 carries for 130 yards, so 10 yards a carry and a touchdown. He had 9 catches for 99 yards. The guy's a beast. I just have one question. I don't know how I could answer it myself, but I'll try. How good would he be with a decent offensive line? I think he'd be amazing. I think the Giants have themselves a gem. They have something that they can build their team around. But the Giants' season is pretty much over. They're 1-5. They just don't look like a good football team. Eli's probably done. If he's not done totally, he's definitely done with the Giants. The Giants will draft a quarterback next year. They might give Eli the start of the season, but Eli's done. It's a three-horse race now in the NFC East. The Redskins are 3-2, and the Cowboys and Eagles are at 3-3. So that's pretty much all I had for football this week. The game last night between the Patriots and Chiefs was exciting. I think that might be a preview of the AFC title game. Patrick Mahomes continues to impress. Tyreek Hill had a hell of a day. But that's all I've got for the NFL. When I come back, I'm going to take a quick break. I'm just going to do a quick run around the Caps and the Wiz. We'll just look in on them, see how they're doing. Wiz are getting ready to start their season. Then we'll talk a little bit about the MLB playoffs, and we'll get out of here. So I'll be back in a bit. Appreciate you guys. Thank you. All right. Before we jump into the mixed bag, I'm going to talk again about the DMVSportsNetwork.com. We are affiliated with them. We have a tab up on their website. They blast our stuff out on social media. We've got a good rapport with those guys. Again, one show that I really enjoy listening to, especially because my fantasy teams are white hot garbage. I listen to Marcus and his Fantasy Fever podcast. Usually comes out Wednesday nights or Thursday mornings, just in time for you to set your fantasy lineups before the Thursday night games. Give him a listen. He's got a nice soothing voice to listen to. And he's got a lot of great information. Things I wouldn't think of, to be honest. I've never been a good fantasy guy. But he certainly has helped. Gives you some nice waiver wire pickups, things to look for. Things that I would be useless at. So it's a good listen. Give that a listen. But also check out DMVSportsNetwork.com. You can also follow them on Twitter at DMV_SN. They are always looking for people to podcast, people to write articles. If you're interested in doing any of that, send a direct message at DMV_SN on Twitter. All right, let's jump into a mixed bag. I'm going to briefly talk about the Caps and the Wizards, and by briefly, I mean very briefly. The Caps, since we last talked, went 1-2. Had a 5-2 win over Vegas at home on Wednesday night. They followed that up with a back-to-back. They had to travel to Jersey. They lost 6-0. Copley got his first start. Gave up 6 goals to Jersey. I wouldn't read too much into that. The Caps season, their schedule to start the season has just been wonky. The Caps are going to be fine. And then they lost. They had a 4-2 loss to Toronto. They play the Rangers and the Panthers this week. Early season hockey. Team looks about as I expect them to look. Tom Wilson did say today that it's been rough being suspended, that he misses being around the guys. And I was hopeful that his suspension would be reduced, but it's not looking good for that. But I'll be glad when they get him back. I'm really looking forward now. They'll be getting into like maybe 2 or 3 games a week. I'm looking forward to watching them a little bit more. Getting to know more about hockey. I have been a passive hockey fan. The only reason I'm watching it more adamantly now, it's not because of the Stanley Cups, because I do this. And I want to know what I'm talking about. So as we progress through the Caps season, I will certainly be more knowledgeable about the Caps. Josh is usually the one that can spit some knowledge, as they say, about the Caps. I look forward to hearing what he has to say next week. I really want to pick Josh's brain, especially as the season develops. I'd like to see the difference between Trotz's strategy and Reardon's strategy. Obviously, Kuznetsov is now on the penalty kill. Josh really liked that. He talked about that last week. I would also like to see, as Josh has stated, I'd like to see Holtby get a little bit more rest. And I think as they get through the season, the Copley will get a little bit more time out there. Keep Holtby nice and fresh throughout the season. The Wizards season opens up this week, Thursday at home against Miami. Not much to talk about there. Dwight Howard's still a question mark. He made his debut on the practice court today, but he is still a giant question mark for whether or not he'll start the season. He's got a lower back, upper buttocks injury that is not healing as quickly as they want, but they do say that it's not serious. But the Wiz, it looks like they're keeping the whole team together. They're going to make one more run with it, with this band of players. They obviously added Jeff Green to the mix. They added Austin Rivers and Dwight Howard if he plays. They open up Thursday at home against Miami. So we'll have more to talk about with them next week as well. But let's talk about the MLB playoffs. I'm going to start with Houston and Boston. I know it's not DC sports related, but it's baseball playoffs and we're in the League Championship Series, so let's talk about it. I think through two games you could say, at least in my opinion, you can say a couple of things. One, Boston, in my opinion, is the better team. They're better offensively. I even think that they're, well, I don't think it's a question that they're better defensively in the outfield, especially with Mookie Betts and Jackie Bradley Jr. If I had to give an edge to a bullpen, I'd probably give it to Houston, although it's close. But the edge to me, and the reason why I think Houston will end up winning the series, is because of their starting pitching. Verlander's going to get at least one more start. He'll probably start game five. He might start game four, but he'll probably start game five. And you've got Garrett Cole again. He'll be game six. Unless they bring Verlander on short rest and they go with him 1, 4, and 7. And with the Red Sox, I mean, you have Chris Sale. But the one thing about Chris Sale, his average velocity in the league division series, the LDS against the Yankees, was in the mid-90s, occasionally high 90s. His average velocity in game one was in the low 90s. It's something to watch. He might be wearing down a bit. I mean, I know he spent some time on the DL this year, but it's something to watch. He's not used to pitching this late into the season. He did last year, but when he was with the White Sox, he never really pitched this late into the season. It will be something to watch with Chris Sale. Porcello has looked great. He will start most likely game four. Eovaldi looked great for the Red Sox against the Yankees. I wonder if he'll be able to keep that going in Houston in game three. But I think Houston's got the edge. They have three consecutive games at home. They were able to take one in Boston. I think it's very possible that we don't go back to Boston. I don't think it'll happen. I think we will go back to Boston. We'll have at least a game six. But I have a couple of questions. One, what is going on with Craig Kimbrell? It's not the question most people have when they're talking about this series. When most people talk about this series, they're talking about David Price. And I'm going to talk about him in a minute. But what is going on with Craig Kimbrell? He's given up a run in every outing that he's had. He has not looked confident. He has not looked stable. It's just, it's a weird thing with these guys. I mean, this guy has been a premier closer for the last pretty much decade. He's one of the best there is, and he's going to get a huge contract in the offseason. I just, maybe he's one of those guys that when the lights get brighter, he can't perform. I'm not willing to put that on him yet, but he has not looked great in his first several appearances with the Red Sox coming out of the pen. He almost gave it away in game four against the Yankees. Last night against Houston, he gave up a run before nailing it down. Luckily, he had a three-run lead. That'll be one of the more interesting storylines moving forward is Craig Kimbrell. Because Alex Cora is using every trick in the book. He had Porcello come and pitch one inning last night, pretty much essentially pushing him back from a game three starter to a game four starter, but he had a 1-2-3 eighth inning. Alex Cora is going to be nifty when it comes to using his bullpen because his depth in the bullpen is not great. But again, I believe Boston is the better team. But Houston, and just slightly, I don't think it's like there's not a huge gap, but I think Boston in general is the better team, top to bottom. You got to love Mookie Betts. You've got to love, I'm a big fan of Benintendi. I think he's a pretty good left fielder. I think he's an up-and-coming offensive star. I think that you've got to love, I mean, how can you not love J.D. Martinez? They're just deep. But Houston is too. I mean, when you got Correa batting in the seventh hole, they're pretty deep. But I do think Boston's a better team. I think Houston wins with better pitching. I think it goes six or seven games. I think Houston wins with better pitching. Verlander was able to shut down the Red Sox in game one. And Sale just didn't look great. I'm hoping it was for sales' sake, I'm not a I'm not rooting for one team or the other, but I'm hoping that it was just a blip and that he'll be back up to 94, 95 miles an hour in game, probably game five. But keep a lookout for that. Watch Sale's velocity and watch if he has a quick hook in game five. He might be gassed. He was gassed in last year's division series, but that's because he John Farrell overused him. And he had over 300 strikeouts, and I think he had 230 or plus innings. This year's a little different. He spent some time on the DL. But I think I think Houston probably wins it in six. I hate to say that I have family members that are big Red Sox fans, but I think that they probably win in six. Sorry about that. Need a little sip of the old whiskey. I'm going to talk about David Price in a second. Let's talk quickly about the Dodgers and the Brewers. They're actually playing right now. The Brewers are up 1-0 in the bottom of the fifth. But the Dodgers do have a runner on second and nobody out. Their series is also tied at 1. Milwaukee came in hot. They had won 11 straight. They won their 12th straight in game 1. And then they were set up to win their 13th straight and go up 2-0 in game 2. But their bullpen, their vaunted bullpen, they finally had a little bit of a break. In game 2, they were up 3-2 and they ended up losing. Milwaukee is that team, though. In my opinion, they're this year's version of the 2015 Royals. If they can get 5 innings out of their starter, and tonight we're in the 5th inning with Julius Chacin, you get 5 innings out of your starter, they'll throw Hader at you, they'll throw Jeffress at you. They just have arm after arm coming out of the bullpen, a lot like the 2015 Royals. It really shortens a game. You can't do that every game. In game 2, Craig Counsell immediately came out because Hader pitched 3 innings in game 1 and said, Hader's unavailable. We sacrificed him to use him in game 1 because we wanted to win game 1. He was unavailable in game 2, and that's probably why they lost. I'm not saying it was a bad strategy, but that's probably why they lost. To me, their teams are surprisingly even. Clayton Kershaw looked human in game 1. I think Kershaw is becoming more human. If you want to talk about it, you do a quick tangent, you want to talk about Clayton Kershaw for a second. Guy has an opt-out at the end of this year. He's the best pitcher of this generation. There's no denying that. And he's not that old. He has been one of the most dominant pitchers in history, really. And he's 30 years old. At the start of next year, he'll be 31. The same age, by the way, Max Scherzer was when he signed his 7-year, $210 million contract. Clayton Kershaw is great. He's got an opt-out after this year. If he doesn't opt out, he'll make almost $35 million in 19 and almost $36 million in 2020. The reason for him to opt out would be because he wants to get more years. Because at 33, who knows what kind of contract he'll get. I don't know how much of him cares about being a Dodger for life. But he's certainly, in my opinion, based just on health, he's starting to decline at 30 years old. He's not like Scherzer, who's got less wear and tear and was starting to take off at 30, or had taken off at 31. Kershaw, to me, I love the guy. I think he can still be a very good pitcher, but he's peaked. If he opts out, I don't think there might be a team that pays him $30 million a year, but I don't think there will be many people. I think he'll make less. But if he wants to get a 6-year deal, he probably could. He could probably get a 6-year deal at 150 and make $25 million a year. I'll be watching him. I don't know if he'll opt out. Maybe the Dodgers try to extend him, basically rip up the last 2 years of his deal. Or maybe the Dodgers see it too. Maybe the Dodgers see what he's done, or I should say, what his stats have done. His ERA the last 3 years. 2016 was the lowest ERA of his career. He had a 1.69 in 21 games started. So he was hurt that year, but he had a 1.69. Amazing. Last year, started 27 games, he had a 2.31. Went up 7/10 of a run, but I mean, there's only one place to go at 1.69. This year in 26 starts, so pretty similar to last year, 2.73 ERA. The big thing for me, his strikeouts have gone down. He had 202 last year. He only had 155 this year. I love the guy. I think he can still be a very good pitcher, but I don't think he is now in the conversation for top five in baseball. So I'll be interested to watch to see if he opts out, because he's only got 2 years left on his deal, but they're at a high number, $35 million, $36 million. I'll be curious to see if he opts. But he'll probably get the ball in game five for the Dodgers. He didn't look terrible in game one, but he looked human. And in the past, he's not always been human. I mean, he's been Clayton Kershaw. If I had to guess, I personally, and I might be a little biased, I'm not a huge fan of the Dodgers, I think Milwaukee wins it in seven. I think this one goes seven. But I think that their bullpen is enough where Craig Counsell can tell his starting pitchers, blow it out for five innings. I need you to give me four or five. You saw what he did in game one. Gio Gonzalez opened the game for him. Gio pitched two innings. That was it. That's all he needed. And then it was a bullpen game from then on out, and they won. The Royals were hard to stop in 2015. This Brewers team is very, very similar. And amazingly enough, have two players from that Royals team in Kane and Moustakas. So I think the Brewers ultimately win it in seven. I think it will go seven. It's their bullpen that will be the final factor. And also, to be quite honest, I don't think the Dodgers' offense is very good, even with the addition of Manny Machado. So I guess I'm sticking with my, I think it'll be Houston and Milwaukee in the World Series. Final thing I'll talk about before I get to my final thought is going to be David Price. Two things. One, the real question is, should the Red Sox start him again in the postseason? His turn will most likely come up unless they get swept in the next three games and lose the series 4-1. His turn will come up. He'll most likely line up to pitch game six. His postseason pitching in general, his career average ERA, in the postseason is 5.42. Prior to last night, his teams had been 0-10 in games that he had started. They won, but not because of him. He last night went 4 2/3, gave up 4 earned runs. In the ALDS, he went 1 2/3. He faced 10 batters, gave up 3 earned. Do you let him start again? I don't know if they have a fourth starter that they think can be better. Steven Wright went down, their knuckleballer, in the ALDS. He's not available in the ALCS. He would be available in the World Series if he's healthy. I don't know if you're Alex Cora, I'd move him to the bullpen. I know you're not paying him to pitch from the bullpen. He's making actually more money than Max Scherzer, which is kind of shocking. But I don't know how you pitch him again in the playoffs. At least as a starter. Maybe for an inning or two, maybe have him be kind of the Andrew Miller type, the hybrid reliever that can give you 2-3 innings when you need it. But that parlays into my next point. Got a bunch of friends up in the Boston area that are Red Sox fans. I went to school up there. I was talking to a buddy last night. Should the Red Sox consider trading David Price in the offseason? It's a multifaceted question for several reasons. David Price has 4 years left on his deal. 4 years at an average salary of around $32 million. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of years. He's 32. He'll be 33 at the start of 2019 or in 2019. So you're paying for his, you would be trading for his 33, 34, 35, 36-year-old seasons. The Red Sox will probably listen to offers. The Red Sox will probably go as far as to say we'll pay part of his contract. If I'm the Red Sox, I say he's owed $32 million a year. We'll pay $11 million a year of it. We'll pay 30% of it, 33% of it. So essentially, if you're trading for him, you're trading for $20 million a year. Then you ask yourself, is David Price? And you're probably not going to give up top prospects. The Red Sox, that would basically be a salary dump. Get him out of the clubhouse. Because he just has not been a good fit in Boston. He has not handled the media well. He has not handled the fan base well. There have been multiple incidents. He had an incident last year with Dennis Eckersley on the plane. Eckersley had been critical in a TV broadcast. And Price basically confronted him on the plane, which is very poor form. It's also why they usually don't let analysts fly on the plane, or at least that was my understanding. And then this year, he had carpal tunnel or something, and a story came out that he played a lot of Fortnite, and then he promised he wouldn't play it in the clubhouse anymore. I mean, it's just, he is not built for Boston. He's not built for a big media town. Boston, New York, L.A., Chicago. He's not built for that. I mean, he became a pro, spent most of his years in Tampa, where they're barely paid attention to. So for me, the Sox are going to try to trade him. And they'll probably give about 33% of his salary. They'll probably pay about... So you're looking at $20 million. So at $20 million, is he worth it? Is he a 4-for-80 if he was a free agent? I think he is. And this is where I'm going to tie it into a local team. I'm going to tie it into the Washington Nationals. The Nationals need a left-handed starter. They have money to spend. And they probably have prospects outside of the top prospects, because the Red Sox can't expect a top prospect. They have prospects to trade. And you're banking on a new atmosphere, a more forgiving fan base, a less... scrutiny heavy, that's probably not the right way to say it, but media, a less intense media, let's put it that way, would benefit him greatly. And I think that he could see a renaissance late in his career. The Reds, and again, the Nats need a left-handed starter at $20 million a year. You got a rotation where Price is now your third starter behind Scherzer and Strauss. That's a quick way for the Nats to rebuild their starting pitching. They're probably not going to get a top flight or a number three starter for much less than that. Maybe they could get one for 15. But if they can get the Sox to pay 33% of his salary, and they can give up maybe a mid-tier or two mid-tier prospects, I don't see a reason not to do it. But I do think that the Red Sox will try to move him in the offseason. He just hasn't been a good fit since he's been there, and they're going to want to try to cut bait out of that contract. And for them, if you look at it, even if they're paying $11 million a year, with the Red Sox, the amount of money that they make, the amount of money they generate, they're still saving $20 million a year, even if they're paying $11 million. So that's one of my storylines in the offseason. I'm going to move into my final thought. And I'm going to use this opportunity because Josh is not here. And whenever the topic of Bryce Harper comes up around Josh, his eyes turn red. Flames start to shoot out of his ears. I mean, the guy hates Bryce Harper with the fire of 1,000 suns. I haven't been able to put my finger on the exact reason why. Probably because he's never lived up to the hype. Probably because he markets himself like he's one of the best players in the game. His stats sometimes say otherwise. All of those are, I guess, valid reasons to dislike a guy. I don't know why he hates him so much. But again, that's Josh's prerogative. I'm going to take this opportunity to talk about Bryce Harper without somebody screaming at me. I'm going to be positive. Bryce Harper at the start of next year will be 26 years old. The reason I'm bringing this up as my final thought is literally right before I started recording this. Bryce, I guess, posted in his Instagram stories a picture that had him, Juan Soto, and Victor Robles. And at the top of the picture, it said, top flight. And the internet, top flight. the internet is going, well, at least the Twitterverse is going bananas. They think this is a sign, well, he's got to be staying. He's got to be. I'm not going to go that far. I think this is a sign that he wants to stay. I think this is a sign that he sees what's on the horizon, what teams may want to sign him. And he's like, I think I'm happy where I am. And there might even be a little part of him that goes, I really wish I had negotiated an extension and not gotten to this point. So I think he definitely wants to stay. He wants to stay for a number of reasons. Josh has said, why wouldn't he want to stay? Because he's treated with kid gloves. That might be true. I think he wants to stay because he's built something here, not just professionally, but personally. And I do believe that he is a fan of the history of the game and that he has a lot of respect for the guys that have played their entire careers in one city. And I think he wants to be one of those guys if he can be. So the question is, how do the Nats keep him if they want to keep him? In my opinion, they can't realistically field a competitive team and pay Bryce Harper $30 to $35 million a year. They can't. They can't do it. Doesn't matter how inexpensive your outfield is for the next 6 years with Soto and Robles. Because towards the end of that, their arbitration numbers are going to get pretty high. You have to decide what to do with Anthony Rendon. I mean, you have Trey Turner for the next 4 years under arbitration, but his number is going to start to escalate. So, I look at it, the only way, and it's actually a two-part thing, the only way the Nats keep Bryce Harper, he's going to have to take less money to stay here. And that's if, and the caveat here too is, that's if Mike Rizzo has full control over this. I think Mike Rizzo loves Bryce Harper, but I also think that Mike Rizzo understands the economics of the game. So Bryce will have to take a, in my opinion, backloaded contract where the last, let's say they sign him for 10 years, the last 4 years are going to be more money. That's the step one. It's going to have to be a backloaded contract where the first several years are maybe, if he's averaging $30 million a year, the first 4 years he's going to get maybe 25. Because then you hope that the luxury tax goes up, all of those things. Also in 4 years, I mean, you're coming towards the end of the Strasburg contract. Max Scherzer's contract will be done. You'll have a little bit more money. But then again, Robles and Soto will be coming up. So it's going to have to be a backloaded contract. And I do think there's going to have to be what the learners love, which is deferred money. I don't think it'll be Bonilla-type deferred money, but I think it might be Scherzer-type deferred money. For those of you who don't know or don't remember, Scherzer signed a 7-year, $210 million deal. And it essentially paid him half the money during the 7 years, and then the second half, the $105 million, is paid over the last 7 years. So 7 years, for the next 7 years after Scherzer's done pitching in Washington, he'll still make $15 million a year. It's deferred money. It's the idea of present value versus future value. Present value money is worth more than future value money. It's an economics thing. But if you do that with enough people, you get to a certain point in your future where you don't have any money left. But anyway, I think it'll have to be a backloaded contract. I think there'll have to be deferred money. And I do think he'll have to take a slight hometown discount if he wants to stay. And it's quite possible when he hits free agency that he's going to find out that the suitors aren't what he thought they'd be. How many people want to pay an outfielder $25 to $30 million a year who, to use a term I used earlier about the Washington Redskins, can be Jekyll and Hyde? Harper has shown flashes of greatness. 2015, his MVP season, he had an OPS of 1.109. Last year, 2017, he had an OPS over 1,000. But the years in between, 2016, granted he was probably hurt, he had an OPS of 814. This year, because of a ridiculous second half, he had a OPS of 0.889. He's a 900 OPS guy. I mean, that's a well above average player. Is he worth $30 million a year? That's debatable. Just on the field, no. You'd have to include what he means for box office, what he means for jersey sales, all of that stuff, marketing. He wants to stay. I think he realized that partially at the All-Star game. I think he realized that through the first 3-4 months of the season when he was like, why am I putting myself through this? I like being here. And then he also probably noticed that his suitors weren't going to be as vast as he thought. There aren't many teams out there that can afford a $300 million contract and can afford one for an outfielder. The Yankees will probably dole out a $300 million contract if Manny Machado is willing to come to New York. They're not going to do it for an outfielder. Their outfield is stacked. The Cubs are probably not going to pay $300 million to Bryce Harper. They want to lock up Rizzo and Bryant. And eventually, Javi Baez. So you're looking at the Giants, who are not one player away from being a contender. Potentially the Dodgers, but they've got a lot of young talent. And they might be more focused on keeping Clayton Kershaw. They might even be more focused on keeping Manny Machado, even though Corey Seager's coming back. His options are not as vast as he thinks. It might be 4 or 5 teams. Philly certainly in there. Atlanta, the Nats. The Cubs are probably in there. I mean, the betting sites have them at even money. I don't know why. But he wants to stay. Emotionally, I want him to stay, but business-wise, I'd like them to, and I've said this on previous podcasts, I'd like to see them lock up, Rendon. I'd also like to see them buy out the last 4 years of Turner's arbitration, tack 2 more on, get a 6-year deal for him. And I'd approach, and I've said this before, I'd approach Tanner Roark after a down season, and I'd say, hey, we want you to be a Nat for the next 5 years. What will it take? I think you can get him at $10 to $12 million a year, which is pretty reasonable for a pitcher of his caliber. The Nats offseason is going to be fascinating. We're going to do a lot. We're going to talk a lot about it. That's all I've got for today. I survived my first solo podcast. I feel pretty good about it, too. Just going to remind you guys, don't forget to check out the DMVSportsNetwork.com. Follow them on Twitter at DMV_SN. If you want to join their team, do a podcast, talk about sports, write articles, contact them via Twitter at DMV_SN or via their website, DMVSportsNetwork.com. Again, a big podcast that they put on or that they're affiliated with that I'm a big fan of. Marcus puts on a great podcast with Fantasy Fever. You can find it at DMVSportsNetwork.com or you can also find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. It's About Time, DC Sports. We appreciate all the follows. We appreciate if you follow us on Twitter. It's About Time, DC1. ITS, About Time, DC1. So check us out there. Let me know how terrible of a job I did this go-around. We'll talk to you guys next week after a Redskins-Cowboys game. I think the Redskins are going to be 4-2. They're going to be looking good in the NFC East. They may have found something to sustain their momentum, something that'll keep them angry. I hope, at least. We'll see you guys next week. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.